So if you want, which is what they do want, a world government, a world central bank, a world army, an amalgamation of NATO and the UN peacekeeping operation, a world currency, electronic, no cash, and a microchip population, then what you've got to do, and this is the way they work, a process I call problem, reaction, solution, you've got to keep creating the problems, get the people to react, do something in fear and outrage, all of what's happening, what they're going to do about it, and then they, who've covertly created the problem, offer the solutions to the problems they've created, which is the constant centralization of power. That's what all the solutions are. And we're seeing such a wonderful example now with what's happening in the financial industry.
Absolutely.
And
absolutely,
if we don't wake up, we're going to live in a global fascist dictatorship within 5 to 10 years.
For we are opposed around the world by a monolithic and ruthless conspiracy that relies primarily on covert means for expanding its sphere of influence, on infiltration instead of invasion, on subversion instead of elections, on intimidation instead of free choice, on guerrillas by night instead of armies by day.
Hello and welcome to the podcast. Before the podcast starts, hey, you can help support the podcast by supporting our affiliate partners at Health Ranger. Health Ranger offers clean, laboratory-verified nutritional supplements, organic foods, organic storable foods, and preparedness items. So when you purchase from Health Ranger, we'll receive a small commission. You can also support the podcast by going to our Patreon page, patreon.com/fringenews. You could donate as little as a dollar a month, kind of as a tip, or you could donate $1.99 and receive some bonus information and shows. You can get all that for pennies per day. You can help support the podcast. So please check out our patreon.com/fringenews. Also, you can help support the podcast by purchasing from our store. To purchase from our store, go to the Linktree page, linktree.com/fringenews. Or you can find the link at the top of our show notes. All of our links are there. So if you receive value from this podcast, please donate or support my affiliate partners. And then also, before we move on, I want to let you know we now have a blog. We have articles we post up weekly. You can find it at fringefilespodcast.blogspot.com, or you can just follow the link in the show notes. So this week we're going to be focusing on the New World Order, the NWO. The NWO is a conspiracy theory that hypothesizes a secretly emerging totalitarian world government. So the common theme in conspiracy theories about a new world order is that it's a secretive power elite with a globalist agenda, and it's conspiring to eventually rule the world through a one world government, which will replace the sovereign nation states and all-encompassing propaganda whose ideology hails the establishment of the new world order as an accumulation of history's progress. The term New World Order references to the emerging bureaucratic totalitarian one-world government. Many influential historical and conspiracy figures have therefore been alleged to be a part of the cabal that operates through many front organizations to orchestrate significant political and financial events ranging from causing systematic crisis to pushing through controversial policies at both national and international levels as it steps into the ongoing plot to achieve world domination. One of those notable figures that we're going to focus on tonight is G. Edward Griffin. G. Edward Griffin was born November 7, 1931. He is an American author, filmmaker, conspiracy theorist, and founder of the Freedom Force International. Listed in the Who's Who of America, and is well known because of his talents of researching difficult topics and presenting them in clear terms that all can understand. He's the author of The Creature from Jekyll Island, which is about the Federal Reserve System. And if you're not familiar with the Federal Reserve System, it's a central banking system that the United States of America uses. It was created on December 23, 1913, with the enactment of the Federal Reserve Act. After a series of financial panics that led to the desire of the central control of the monetary system in order to alleviate financial crisis, Griffith and many others opposed the Federal Reserve System since the 1960s, saying it constitutes a banking cartel and is an instrument for war and totalitarianism. So I have a couple audio clips of Griffin discussing his most well-known book, The Creature from Jekyll Island. This will probably be one or two. Oh, it's going to be a one-parter, but it'll probably be a two-parter, maybe even a three-parter, trying to get all the clips in. Then I'll be back after these clips.
And to try and give it some kind of historical perspective, I'd like to go back to the first century B.C., to a tiny kingdom called Phrygia. It was in Phrygia that there was a philosopher by the name of Epictetus. And it was Epictetus who said, appearances are of four kinds. Things either are as they appear to be, or they neither are nor appear to be, or they are but do not appear to be, or they are not and yet appear to be. There'll be a quiz on this. When I read that statement, I was sure that if Epictetus were alive today, he probably would be a Harvard professor of banking and economics. Because doesn't that sound like the kind of explanations that we get when you read through the Federal Reserve bulletins trying to tell you what the money aggregates are and that kind of thing? See, what Epictetus did was he took a relatively simple concept, but by the time he was through explaining it, we didn't have any idea what he was talking about. And this is so commonly done today by the experts. Nevertheless, I thought that his statement was pretty good because it provided us with a track to run on, kind of a theme for this presentation. Because, you know, if there's anything in the world that is an appearance which is deceiving, it is the Federal Reserve System. In fact, it is one of those appearances of the fourth kind, which I'm sure you all remember, were those appearances which are not and yet appear to be. So I'd like to use that as my theme for this topic and come back to it now and then during the progress of this presentation, if I remember to do that, and use it as a punctuation point here and there and as a reminder of one of the most important aspects about the Federal Reserve System that there is to comprehend, and that is that there are a lot of deceptive appearances going on here. I think the best place to begin our story is with the creation of the Federal Reserve System itself. In fact, that takes us right to the reason for the title of the book, The Creature from Jekyll Island. For those of you who are not yet familiar with the background of this story, you should know that Jekyll Island is a real island. It's off the coast of Georgia. And it was on that island in 1910 that the Federal Reserve System was conceived at a highly secret meeting that took place there. When things are done in secret, there's usually something to hide. And so I'd like to tell you that story and document it so that we can find out, first of all, that there was a meeting, that the Federal Reserve was indeed created there, that indeed there was a great deal of secrecy, and then we'll ask the question, why the secrecy? In 1910, Jekyll Island was completely owned by a small group of millionaires from New York. People such as J.P. Morgan, William Rockefeller, and their associates. This is where their families came to spend the winter months. It was a resort island. It was called the Jekyll Island Club. And on the island, there was a magnificent clubhouse, which was the center of their social activities. You can visit that clubhouse today, as a matter of fact. The island has since been purchased by the state of Georgia, and the clubhouse has been fully restored. It's a beautiful thing. And if you take the tour, you can walk down the corridor there, and there will be a room, and on the door to that room is a brass plaque, and it says, the Federal Reserve System was created in this room. So there's no secret about this part of it. It's a matter of public record. So this is how that story came to pass. It was November of that year, 1910, when Senator Nelson Aldridge sent his private railroad car to the New Jersey Railroad Station late in the evening. And there it was in readiness for the arrival of himself and six other men who were told to come under conditions of extreme secrecy. For example, they were told to come one at a time, not to dine with each other on the night of their departure.
They were told to avoid arriving at the same time if they could. If they should happen to show up at the same time, they were instructed to pretend not to even know each other. They had to avoid newspaper reporters because they were well-known people, and newspaper reporters often frequented the railroad station. Had they been seen, questions would have been asked, especially if several of them had been seen together. One of the men carried a shotgun in a big black case, so that if he had been asked where he was going, he was prepared to say that he was going on a duck hunting trip. The interesting thing about that is that we find out from his biography that this man never fired a gun in his life. He didn't even own one. He borrowed that shotgun just for the purpose of deception and camouflage. Even after they got on board this private railroad car, this pattern continued. They were instructed to use their first names only, to avoid last names. And a couple of them even abandoned their first names and chose code names. The reason for that was so that the servants on board the train would not know who these men were, because they were afraid if the servants had talked about it, word had leaked out in that fashion, then the purpose of the meeting could have been defeated. So absolute secrecy was essential all the way up and down the line. The private railroad car traveled for two nights and a day on a 1,000-mile journey to the south. And when they awoke the second morning, the car was on the siding at Brunswick, Georgia. There they took a ferry boat across the Inland Strait to Jekyll Island, then to the clubhouse. And for the next 9 days, they sat around a table and they hammered out all of the important details of what eventually became the Federal Reserve System. When they were done, they went back to New York. And for quite a few years after that, they denied that such a meeting ever took place. It wasn't until after the Federal Reserve System was firmly established that only then did they begin to talk openly about their meeting and what they accomplished there. Several of them wrote books on it. One of them wrote a magazine article. And they gave interviews to newspaper reporters. And so now, many years later, it's possible for us to go back to the public record and discover in minute detail exactly what happened on Jekyll Island in 1910. Now, who were these seven men? The first one I've already mentioned, Senator Nelson Aldrich. He was the fellow that owned the private railroad car. He was the Republican whip in the Senate. He was chairman of the National Monetary Commission, which was that special committee of Congress created to make a recommendation for legislative reform. Banking reform, they called it. They wanted to reform banking in America because the American people were very concerned over the concentration of financial power into the hands of a small group of banks and investment firms in New York on Wall Street. That is what they called the money trust. That was a popular phrase. In fact, quite a few politicians had been successfully elected to office on their campaign promise to break the grip of the money trust. And that was one of the primary purposes of the National Monetary Commission, of which Senator Aldrich was chairman. He was also a business associate of J.P. Morgan. He was the father-in-law of John D. Rockefeller, Jr., which means, of course, that eventually he became the grandfather of Nelson Rockefeller, our former vice president. Remember, his full name was Nelson Aldrich Rockefeller, so he derived his middle name from his famous grandfather. The second man at the meeting was Abraham Piatt Andrew, Assistant Secretary of the Treasury. Later, he became a congressman, and throughout his career, he was very important in banking circles. The third man there was Frank Vanderlip, president of the National City Bank of New York, the largest and most powerful of all the banks in America. Representing the financial interests of William Rockefeller and the international investment firm of Kuhn, Loeb & Company. Henry Davison was there. He was the senior partner of the J.P. Morgan Company. Charles Norton was there, president of the First National Bank of New York, another one of the giants. Also, there was Benjamin Strong, head of J.P. Morgan's Bankers Trust Company. And incidentally, Benjamin Strong, 3 years later, when the Federal Reserve Act was finally passed, he became the first head of the Federal Reserve System. And finally, last but certainly not least, Paul Warburg was there, probably the most important man because of his knowledge of banking in Europe. Warburg was born in Germany, eventually became a naturalized American citizen. He was a partner in Kuhn Loeb & Company. But he was also a representative of the Rothschild banking dynasty in England and France. And throughout his whole banking career, he maintained close business liaison with his brother, Max Warburg, who was head of the Warburg Banking Consortium in Germany and the Netherlands. Paul Warburg was one of the wealthiest men in the world. But those are the seven men on Jekyll Island. And as incredible as it may seem, these men represented directly and indirectly approximately one-fourth of the wealth of the entire world in those days. And these are the men who sat around a table on Jekyll Island and created the Federal Reserve System. Does it arouse your curiosity? What's going on here? Now, for the skeptics who are here tonight, and I hope there are plenty, because if there aren't, I feel like the minister talking to the choir. I know there are always plenty of skeptics in my audiences, and that makes me feel very good. For the skeptics, you're probably wondering, did it really happen that way? Surely Griffin is exaggerating to make a point. Well, yes, it really happened that way, and I'd like to illustrate that by quoting for you just one piece of evidence here. This was taken from an article that was written by Frank Vanderlip himself that appeared in the Saturday Evening Post on February 9, 1935. Remember, Vanderlip was one of those at the meeting. And this is what he said. I do not feel it is any exaggeration to speak of our secret expedition to Jekyll Island as the occasion of the actual conception of what eventually became the Federal Reserve System. We were told to leave our last names behind us. We were told further that we should avoid dining together on the night of our departure. We were instructed to come one at a time and as unobtrusively as possible to the railroad terminal on the New Jersey littoral of the Hudson, where Senator Aldridge's private car would be in readiness, attached to the rear end of a train to the south. Once aboard the private car, we began to observe the taboo that had been fixed on last names. We addressed one another as Ben, Paul, Nelson, and Abe. Davison and I adopted even deeper disguises, abandoning our first names. On the theory that we were always right, he became Wilbur and I became Orville, after those two aviation pioneers, the Wright brothers. The servants and train crew may have known the identities of one or two of us, but they did not know all. And it was the names of all printed together that would have made our mysterious journey significant in Washington, in Wall Street, even in London. Discovery, we knew, simply must not happen. Well, why? Why the secrecy? What's the big deal here? What's wrong with a group of bankers going to a private location and discussing banking or banking legislation? And the answer to that is provided by Vanderlip himself in the same article. He said, "If it were to be exposed publicly that our particular group had got together and written a banking bill, that bill would have no chance whatever of passage by Congress." Why not? Because the purpose of the bill was to break the grip of the money trust. And ladies and gentlemen, it was written by the money trust. It's as simple as that. Had the public been aware of that fact, at the beginning we would never have had a Federal Reserve System. That was like asking the fox to build the hen house and install the security system. Absolute secrecy was essential for that reason. Congress would never have gone for it. the public would never have gone for it. So there we're face to face with a very important fact about the Federal Reserve System that is not generally known today. It certainly wasn't known then. And that it was formed in secrecy because there was deception at work here. But there's more to it than that, much, much more. Analyze for a moment the composition of that group. Doesn't it seem strange to you that these men were all together? Here we had the Morgans, the Rockefellers, Kuhn Loeb and Company, the Rothschilds, the Warburgs, all sitting around a table here, coming to an agreement. Anything strange about that mixture? Well, ladies and gentlemen, these were competitors. What's going on here? Competitors sitting around, coming to an agreement. These were the giants in the investment field, which prior to this period were beating their heads against each other, blood all over the battlefields, fighting for dominance in the financial markets of the world, not only in New York, but Paris and London, everywhere. And they're coming to an agreement of some kind. This is an extremely important fact that is generally overlooked, because it happened precisely at that point in American history, which is sometimes described in our history books as the period of the dawning of the cartel. This was that point in American history when a major ideological transition was taking place in business. Big businesses, which had grown to great power and size and prosperity through the process of free enterprise competition, which is what made this nation great and allowed us to surpass the old world, now we're in the throes of converting their ideology to that of monopoly, the avoidance of competition. It was John D. Rockefeller the First who said it. He said, "Competition is a sin." And it became the destiny of these people to avoid competition now at all costs. Their life effort was to eliminate their competition if they could. If that was impossible, then to buy them out. If that was impossible, then to join with them in a shared monopoly, which is called a cartel. And this was the period of history when that transition was taking place very rapidly in all industries. For the 15-year period prior to the meeting on Jekyll Island, these financial groups of which we are speaking had increasingly come together in joint ventures rather than compete with each other. They found that it worked. They liked it. And the meeting on Jekyll Island was the culmination of that process. And now we come to the second astounding realization about the Federal Reserve System, is that it is not a government operation at all. It is, in fact, a cartel. They created a banking cartel and legalized it by law, passed a law to make it legal and to enforce it. That is an amazing understanding of the Federal Reserve that you're not going to find taught in your textbooks. It is a cartel. But there is a third element that is even more important than those two for an understanding of what it's doing to us. And the third element that we must understand is that this cartel went into partnership with the government. Cartels often do that to enforce their cartel agreements, but in this case, they did it in spades. Now, when a partnership is formed, there has to be a reason. There has to be a benefit for the partners, or they're not going to do it. So it's a legitimate area of inquiry for us to know and to ask, what's the payoff to these partners? Why did they do that? Why is the government in it? What does it get out of it? And then we'll ask and find out why the...
All right, I think this is a good place to wrap it up for this week. Looks like we're probably going to do part two next week, and this will end up probably being a three-parter so we don't get too long. But also I'm going to include some bonus information at the end of this podcast. So even though I'm going to do my outro, I'm still going to add some extra content on the back. So thank you for being part of the podcast. Don't forget you can follow us at Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube. Join us next week as we search for the cosmic truth.
Some atheists attempt at refuting Christianity, but only end up revealing they don't understand Christianity. Hi, I'm Tim Barnett, and today we're applying some red pen logic to a tweet from Atheist Republic. Class is in session. Atheist Republic offers three propositions to try to show there's a contradiction in the theistic worldview. First, everything has a creator. Second, God is that creator. And third, God does not have a creator. And then they pull out the red pen. I wonder where they got that idea. And they write, your solution fails when it violates its own premise. And they draw an arrow. Let's pull out our red pen and break this down. Atheist Republic gets off to a really, really bad start. The first premise is false. Game over. This concludes our time together. Just kidding. You see, no Christian apologist makes that first claim. We don't believe that everything has a creator. We believe that everything that begins to exist has a cause. That's a fundamental distinction, because if God did not begin to exist, then he doesn't need a cause or creator. Notice Atheist Republic's faulty argument is based on a complete misunderstanding of what Christians actually believe. The second premise is true with an important qualification. God is the creator of everything that begins to exist. The third premise is also true. We believe that God does not have a creator. Atheist Republic says that the solution fails when it violates its own premise. But that's not our premise, it's theirs. We don't believe the first premise. Therefore, the solution does not violate what we actually believe. This is a textbook example of a straw man fallacy. When you defeat a defenseless imitation of an argument, the scarecrow, instead of the real thing. In other words, it's easier to knock over a straw man than a real man. I find it really hard to believe that Atheist Republic did not know that we believe everything that begins to exist has a cause. It's literally the most popular argument that Christians use. Now let's summarize what we've learned. Christians do not believe that everything has a creator. If we did, God would also need a creator. We believe that everything that begins to exist, human beings, the universe, cool mugs, has a cause. So if God did not begin to exist, then he does not need a cause or creator. Atheist Republic is promulgating a straw man. Not cool, Atheist Republic, not cool. The red pen is not a toy. Think critically before you take the cap off. Class dismissed. If you want more Clear Thinking Christianity, be sure to subscribe to STR Video's YouTube channel, where we release a new training video each week.